argument. And now the next case, U.S. versus Perez. And Mr. Truitt.
May it please the court, and welcome to the court, Judge Tinder.
Thank you.
The defendant contends in this case that the presumption of reasonableness at the appellate level, as announced in this circuit in the Demery decision and as enunciated by the United States Supreme Court in United States versus Rita, does not apply. And the presumption, that presumption of reasonableness was based on two factors. One, that the Sentencing Commission, based on their expertise and experience and analysis of records and convictions and scientific research, indicated that that would be the appropriate sentence. And also a federal district court judge correctly applying the 3553 factors came to the same conclusion. And we think that that presumption is not valid in this particular case because the Judge Miller did not correctly apply the 18 United States Code Section 3553A factors. And he did so on four separate occasions. When on four of the 3553A factors, he determined that the sentencing guidelines were the best indicator for, one, the seriousness of the crime, two, the need for the sentence to promote respect for law, three, the need for the sentence to impose just punishment, and four, that the sentence needed to avoid unwarranted sentencing departures.
You think that's applying a presumption of reasonableness to the guideline sentence?
I think it puts the guidelines in a position of prominence that I don't think the Supreme Court in the United States versus Reeder or the United States versus Gall intended. I think it's undue influence on the, and I think it's in direct violation of Reeder's command that the judge make an analysis of each and every sentencing factor or purpose under 3553. And I think when you go to the guidelines or blindly go to the guidelines for something such as seriousness of the offense, in this particular case, distorts the nature of the criminal conduct. Police officers found a sawed-off shotgun in a locked cabinet in Mr. Perez's garage. And when police officers arrived, he told them that he had a gun, and he told them it was in the cabinet, and he gave him a key to enter the cabinet. The facts, as came out at trial, and the undisputed facts, is that the defendant's brother brought the gun to his house, intending to go shooting, didn't, and put the gun in the cabinet, and at no time, at least according to his daughter, did Mr. Perez have the gun in his physical possession. I didn't put it in my brief, but in page 144 of the transcript, Mr. Perez testified that he had asked his brother on numerous occasions to remove the gun and take it because he no longer wanted it in his home. And his brother said, yes, I'll get it tomorrow. And it never came. So when you just say the guidelines are the best factor without analyzing the lack of criminal conduct, now the jury clearly decided that he possessed, and we're bound by that. But the nature of his possession is so minor and so minimal that to rely merely on the guidelines doesn't follow the command of the court in the United States versus Gall. The guidelines have been structured in such a way is that you look at offense conduct and you look at you look at the crime of conviction and you look at criminal history, and a lot of human factors have been programmed out of the original guidelines. The Sentencing Commission, in saying that you have to base your sentencing decision on the individual personal factors of each defendant requires the court to make principled distinctions between conduct. A crime of violence or possession of a sawed-off shotgun, you know, has an initial offense level that doesn't distinction between a brother storing his gun in Mr. Perez's garage from somebody having a sawed-off shotgun at the scene of a crime or carrying it around in a vehicle. And so what the Supreme Court wants sentencing judges to do is to look at that conduct and this is not the norm, or this is more severe than the norm, or this is aggravated. And that wasn't done in this situation. And the court merely relied, and I think elevated a guideline to a position of prominence that it didn't deserve. Also, in terms of just punishment, when you blindly follow the guidelines dictates or without doing that individual analysis as required by the United States versus Gaul, you are not complying with the mandates of Gaul.
Didn't the court discuss the man's education, his citizenship, his criminal record?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. I'm not saying it ignored all of the...
Didn't it also discuss his lack of respect for the law?
Yes, Your Honor. And
didn't the court recite also the need for a just punishment?
Well,
Were the best indication of that?
Well, that's the conclusion that he reached, yes, Your Honor, but I'm not sure if he...
What didn't he discuss? Now, he may not have gone into detail as much as you would have liked. Did you represent him?
I represented him at trial, Your Honor.
All right, didn't you represent him at the sentencing?
I did not, Your Honor. I was on a temporary assignment with the Office of Defender Services when
was sentenced. Wasn't it the attorney's responsibility that did represent him?
Yes,
to ask the court for a more detailed reasoning at that time? Did he question the judge at any time?
According to the record, he did not, Your Honor.
So you're shifting the responsibility to the judge, not to the defense attorney who was retained.
It was Mr. Stevens also from our office, Your Honor.
Well, I don't care where he's from, shouldn't he have asked these questions that you're now condemning the judge for?
I'm not sure if there's a meaningful opportunity to ask questions at a sentencing hearing for clarification.
Doesn't the court ask the defendant to give a statement before he imposes the sentence?
Yes, he does, Your Honor.
And can't he challenge it at that time?
Well,
with his counsel there?
I think that's putting a much greater burden on a defendant than most of them are
his attorney, who's in attendance with him, challenge it at that time? And shouldn't he do that if he's adequately representing him?
Under the scenario that is set forth by this court, that the court must hear from the attorney and the defendant before he announces his proposed sentence, there isn't a meaningful opportunity at that time to ask for clarification or additional fact-finding from the judge. Yes, Mr. Stevens put forth quite a few factors that, in his opinion, felt justified a below-guideline sentence. The judge normally, and I can't remember, so I would assume Judge Miller is very consistent, asked other than the objections that were made prior to the sentencing hearing.
One of the issues here is whether the gun was stolen, as I understand it.
Beg pardon?
I say one of the issues here was whether the gun was stolen.
Whether he should bear culpability because the gun was stolen. The guidelines impose strict liability if the gun was stolen without any showing that the defendant was aware or should have been aware that it was stolen, and that, you know.
Well, are you challenging that now? Or is that
yes, Your Honor. I think that was one of the factors that should have supported or could have supported a below-guideline sentence or a different sentence that was imposed. The sentence, and I understand the sentence, and Mr. Perez is certainly less deserving because he intentionally failed to appear for the sentencing, and I think that cast a pall over the prior proceedings and probably will cast a pall over this court as well. It should. That factor was dealt with in the enhancement for obstruction of justice, and that certainly is part of the sentence. But the sentence that was imposed was 6 months less than the statutory maximum on this case. I understand Mr. Perez had some recent criminal convictions for battery that elevated his sentencing range, but when you look at the facts of the underlying case, the fact that there was no evidence presented that he ever had physical possession of this firearm, that it was locked in a storage cabinet, that he asked his brother to remove it, that the jury disagreed with our analysis that he didn't intend to possess this firearm and found that he did intend to possess the firearm and found him guilty unanimously. I think, you know, we're in an exciting new time in sentencing. And it's a lot more work. It's more work for you. It's more work for us. It's more work for the United States Attorney, and it's certainly a lot more work for the sentencing judge. But instead of blindly computing or ciphering numbers, we can actually talk about the person, and the judge has to consider the individual characteristics of this person and the individual characteristics of the crime and make principal distinctions. Does the guideline compress things too much? Does it not recognize a wide range of conduct?
You can conclude that thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Jesse Barrett. I was trial counsel below. I want to make sure that the Court, as I'm sure you are from reading the briefs, but is fully aware of what Mr. Perez's situation was when he appeared at sentencing. Mr. Truitt cites a couple of facts regarding what his daughter testified at trial. But, I mean, the facts of this case were that police received a midnight 911 call from a 14-year-old boy saying, Mr. Perez is really drunk and he just left to go get a gun to shoot my dad. And then when the police went to his house, he directed them to his gun, which in fact was a sawed-off gun, sawed-off shotgun that was locked in the cabinet. And he identified it as his own gun. And then
Serial number was obliterated.
And the serial number was obliterated. And it wasn't a gun that was just a couple inches shorter. I mean, the barrel had been cut off 5 inches, and the stock was also shortened, so it was a much shorter gun.
Not something you use for target practice or hunting.
Right, exactly, Your Honor. And then after Mr. Perez was convicted, he failed to appear for sentencing. The testimony was that he fled either to California or Mexico, but then apparently came back. And in addition, while he was on release, he incurred another state conviction for battery. So, I mean, that was the full picture of the man that Chief Judge Miller was looking at the sentencing. And Mr. Truitt, you know, refers to how judges shouldn't blindly follow the guidelines, but there was no blind following here. I mean, it takes 3 pages in the brief to just recite what Judge Miller said at sentencing. He recited all the factors. He recited the fact that the gun was recovered in a locked condition and that it wasn't brandished. But then he also recited the aggravating factors, that it was a gun that it wasn't legal for anyone to possess, and it was following this drunken midnight
call. What was the evidence that the gun was stolen? I was a little confused by that point here.
There was no evidence at trial of the gun being stolen. In the proceedings with the pretrial services report, there was evidence provided by the government that an individual who had once possessed that gun said, I possessed that gun and that gun was stolen from me. And that evidence was not rebutted at the sentencing. It was not challenged. the argument, I think, was not that the gun hadn't been stolen, but rather Mr. Perez shouldn't bear responsibility for that gun having been stolen. I would point out, though, and I think it's important to note, the Seventh Circuit has said that the district court should focus on the factors, particularly, that parties raise at the sentencing. At the sentencing, Mr. Perez's counsel never addressed the fact that this really wasn't Mr. Perez's gun. He never addressed the fact that supposedly his brother had given it to him. So Mr. Perez would now have the judge go back to the record to find testimony, which the defendant didn't even raise as a mitigating factor at the sentencing. Those issues were never put before Judge Miller. So what Judge Miller did is he went back and he did certainly review the testimony, but he focused on the factors and the facts to which the parties directed him. And for now on appeal, for us to argue that Judge Miller should have addressed facts that Mr. Perez didn't put before him, I think puts an undue weight on the district judge in this situation.
One of the guidelines is that the fact that it's a stolen gun, is that strict liability, or is it relevant whether he knew about it or didn't know about it? What's the law on that?
What the guidelines say is that if a gun is stolen, then an enhancement should be applied. So the guidelines, I mean, to adopt the strict liability term, phraseology, yes, the guidelines do speak in terms of strict liability, although obviously under Section 3553, that's not binding. That is what the guidelines say. But I would point out that the issue of the gun being stolen, I don't think that was a defining issue at the sentencing sort of by either party. The facts that the court focused on and that the parties focused on were the nature and circumstances of the offense and the history and characteristics of Mr. Perez. Those are the characteristics to which the parties directed the court. That was where the court hung its hat in the sentencing analysis. And while it is certainly true that the court did say for those four particular factors that Mr. Truitt addresses, that the guidelines are ordinarily the best indication, I mean, the Seventh Circuit itself has said in the Schmidt case that disparities are at their ebb when the guidelines are followed. So it's not as though the court somehow constructed out of whole cloth this notion that the guidelines are still helpful in reducing disparities and in approximating the seriousness of the offense. The court addressed the factors, addressed the facts that the parties raised, took into context this defendant who had possessed the sawed-off shotgun, had threatened to get it in a drunken brawl, and then had failed to appear for his sentencing. And I think on the facts before this court and on the facts that were argued before Chief Judge Miller, there's certainly nothing unreasonable about the sentence. If the court doesn't have anything else, I think that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Truitt, I think we ate your time up with some questions. You can have one more minute. Thank you.